You can have a seat. Purple cows. Yeah, that was my deal. See, this one time I was out walking the countryside with my dad, and somehow I became convinced that I had seen a purple cow. I believed it wholeheartedly, and when I went back to school, I started telling my friends, you know, I was out, you know, doing this thing with my dad, I saw a purple cow. Of course, I got made fun of for like weeks, you know, I was the purple cow guy, but in my mind, I just knew what I had seen. I was convinced, and no matter what anybody told me, I believed that I had seen a purple cow. And I went on this almost crusade to convince everybody that I knew that there were purple cows. I knew it. I had seen one. I was thoroughly convinced, okay? And it was a, you know, something that, you know, a few weeks later I had, you know, very traumatic moments because, you know, people just kept making fun of me, and I, you know, went into a deep depression, and, you know, because I'd seen one thing, but, you know, everybody made fun of me, and I just wasn't quite sure what to wrestle with. Well, you know, as I've grown up, I'm not sure why I believed that or what I saw, but I haven't seen any purple cows since then, and there's no purple cows in magazines, and so what do I do with that? Well, I can choose just to believe because I choose to believe, or I can kind of wrestle with evidence and realize that, you know, purple cows aren't a common item. There's, you know, just not many purple cow farms out there unless people are smoking something, right? And so we're good at that. We like conspiracy theories. We like when people come up with stories that we can believe, that make us believe that, you know, all kinds of people were involved. The Kennedy assassination. In fact, the movie JFK a few years ago really played on that. As Oliver Stone kind of gave us a story about maybe the way that assassination took place. And people really loved the movie because it was so, he gave us facts that he wanted us to know while ignoring other facts that were out there to convince us something was true, even though there may have been evidence on the other side. We love those kind of things. We love to buy into things where you know, we're convinced that, you know, there's got to be more to it than just what we know. And we've been, last couple weeks, we've been looking at the book and the movie The Da Vinci Code. It's a kind of a hot thing in culture right now, and we thought we'd take a week or two just to talk about it because we feel like this is a this being in our culture gives people who have faith in Jesus a chance to really dialogue with the culture, to interact with people. I've really found that, you know, you can be in a restaurant or in any situation, and if you just go, hey, what do you think about the Da Vinci Code, you can have a conversation with someone. And you may be here today, and maybe you haven't even seen the movie, heard the story, don't know anything about it, you know, in the media. Maybe you've seen the book and you're wrestling with it because it raises a lot of issues, a lot of ideas, a lot of problems if the things are true in here for people of the Christian faith. Or maybe you're here today and you're kind of thinking, you know what? I know that I need to talk to people about this. I know that people are searching and seeking, but I don't really know how to respond to them. Well, my goal today is to help you wrestle not only with the Da Vinci Code, but with a couple of the questions that are raised by that. But as I read this book, I really came to realize that he was putting out ideas that were like my purple cow. He had come up with a lot of concepts and ideas about who Jesus was, what the church believed, and he decides to believe them, Dan Brown does. The characters in the story fully believe their theories, even though the facts may be different. Now, I'm a Seinfeld fan personally. I don't know if you guys like Seinfeld, but as I was reading through this book, I started thinking of this episode of Seinfeld where, instead of me telling you, why don't you watch the screen? Well, Kramer and Newman have a problem. What seems to be the facts point one way, but what their heart and what they want to believe points a different way. And sometimes that's where we're at. And that's what I want to wrestle with. What do the facts tell us? What does the not only the scriptures, but the story tell us? Because in the book Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown really raises a lot of issues, but is he telling the truth? Does the story tell the truth? Now, last week I spent a little time synopsizing the book. I'm not going to do that today. If you are interested in that and you weren't here last week, I'd encourage you, you can hop on our website. Our messages are online, and you can listen to that last week. We're kind of wrestling with five different questions that are kind of around the room here. We looked at Jesus and Mary Magdalene last week and wrestled with, was Jesus married? And the facts tell us, no, that's not anywhere remotely possible, that if that was true, there would be a lot of evidence of that, but there's none. But this week, we're going to look at how the early church passed on truth. And kind of to get us thinking about that, I'd like to look at a character in the Bible and a story where a person interacted with Jesus and asked what I think may be one of the most important questions in all the Bible. Pilate was a man who was a governor that was sent by the Roman Empire to oversee Jerusalem, to oversee a portion of Israel. And while he's there, the Jewish people bring Jesus to Pilate for a trial. Now, Pilate isn't quite sure what to do with this. Pilate is in a lot of hot water with the Roman government at this point in time because there had been a lot of civil unrest. And that's the one thing Rome didn't really like putting up with, was civil unrest. They wanted everybody to be happy and just serve the Roman government. But the Jews weren't doing that very well, and he had gotten himself in a lot of hot water, where if there was one more big insurrection, Rome would probably just take him, cut him off, take his power away from him, and he wasn't quite sure what to do. And so the rulers of the Jews bring Jesus to Pilate and say, you know what, this guy's causing a lot of trouble. He's claiming to be God. He's claiming to be our Messiah. We don't buy into it. We really would like to kill him. We'd like to crucify him. We'd like to execute him because he's broken our laws. And so now Jesus is before this guy, Pilate, and now he is in a situation where Pilate is conducting a trial and he's interviewing Jesus. If you have your Bible, turn to John chapter 18. And we will look at a little bit of this story. If you don't have a Bible, at the end of your row there, we have some Bibles for you. We'd love for you to take one of those. If you have one of those Bible, it's going to be on page 774. And we would love for you to keep that Bible as a gift from us to you so that you can have that. Grab one and just read along with me. We'll be in chapter 18 of the book of John, and I'll begin with verse 33. Pilate enters his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests had delivered you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world." Then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." And here's the question. Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" One of the reasons I think this story plays out in our culture so well is because we, as a culture, are wrestling with truth and have just kind of come to the point where we decide we don't believe anything's true. What is truth? That's kind of the mantra of our world right now, the mantra of our culture. We believe whatever we want to. If I hold my beliefs, they're true. They're true for me. They may not be true for you, but they're true for me. And so as this book is written and put out here, people believe it's true because it's at least true for Dan Brown. But he raises a lot of questions about the Christianity, the faith that we hold, asking whether or not our faith is true, which is funny. That's okay. It's not okay to ask questions about other people's belief, but it's okay to say that our belief, if you're a believer in Jesus, those beliefs aren't true. But he puts out some ideas that are struggles. And this isn't new. There's nothing new under the sun here. People have been questioning Jesus and Christianity and God for all of creation, all the way back to the garden where Satan himself in the form of a serpent started questioning God. And sometimes, I don't know about you, but for me, that can be a point where I'm not quite sure what to do with it. And I feel like somehow I have to defend God. And I just want to give you some thoughts about that, because I want you to understand some things about the nature of the Christian faith that maybe will help you. Because sometimes when these attacks come, we hear them, we go, "Oh, well, what if this is true? What if that is true?" And if you can understand some bedrock things about Christianity, about what the Bible teaches and about who Jesus is, and some bedrock things about this, I think it will help you be at ease, be at comfort, to understand that when people raise questions, there is always a good, reasonable, well-thought-out, and intelligent answer to the questions that are raised. But what happens, much like, Kramer and Newman, they have chosen to believe this, even though maybe the truth doesn't dictate that that's necessarily so. So what do we do in those times? Well, let me tell you some things about Christianity. First of all, I want you to know that Christianity is revealed. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is that Christianity is a form of thinking, and I don't think Christianity is a religion. I'm not really a big into religion guy, meaning that God's up there somewhere and I'm down here, and if I work really hard and do all the right things and I keep all the rules, somehow I can get to God. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that everything about Christianity, everything about Jesus, everything about the faith that has been passed on for the last 2,000 years starts with the fact that it is all about God coming to us. It is not us trying to figure God out. It is God coming to us and showing us, revealing himself to us, helping us see himself, which means that if Christianity is a revealed faith, if it is something that God gave to us, he's capable. He can pull off what he wants to do, and I can know that what he is teaching us about himself through the scriptures, through the life of Jesus and other things, I can trust those things because it started with him, not with me. What the book and some other people would want us to believe is that Christianity is not a revealed faith, it's a discovered faith. That, you know, I'm just kind of seeking out God and figuring out what I can about him, and I may be right, you may be right. And it's one thing to believe that, you know, truth is whatever you make of it. It's another thing to say there is a God who is on his throne in heaven. He is showing us himself, and what he says about himself is true. Does that make sense? Christianity is a revealed faith. Which means that when I wrestle and people raise questions, I need to realize there is a God in heaven who has the answers and he will show himself to me. The second thing I want you to understand about Christianity, not only is it a revealed faith, but it is a historic faith. Christianity and the beliefs that Christians hold did not take place in a vacuum. They are things that happened through history, all through history where God showed himself to people. God took the initiative, came to people, and revealed himself to them, and we can see his workings in history. Most of the things that we read in the Bible, including the most important thing, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, are historical facts. They can be demonstrated to be true, and we can wrestle with those things. Christianity and the beliefs that we hold and the things that we understand about the Christian faith, just realize they are historical. They are things that we can find truth in the way God dealt with people. But the third thing I want you to understand is that Christianity is mysterious. This is where I struggle with it, okay? I like to be somebody who has all the answers and I got it all figured out. And sometimes as, you know, a person who is doing what I'm doing, leading a church and all that kind of stuff, people expect me to. And I have to come to the point where I am okay with the fact that there are some things about the Christian faith that are bigger than me and beyond my comprehension. See, this is what I like. I like to have a system that's a nice, neat, tight little box that I can hand somebody and go, here it is. But if I have a system that fits in a nice, neat little box, it's something that my head can comprehend, which means I have a wimpy God that's not very big. We need to be okay with the mystery of the Christian faith. The fact that there are some things that I hold by faith, but as I try to wrap my brain around it, I'm not going to get it. And most of the time when people end up in error in terms of looking at beliefs, it's because they're trying to come to a point where they can rationalize things that are bigger than them. Mystery is okay. It's okay to have things that are points of tension as long as they start with the God who revealed himself. And so when people challenge you and say, well, you believe this and you believe this, how can we need to realize it's okay sometimes to have points where I go, you know what? I don't know. I know God has an answer to that. I can try to find that. But if I can figure out everything about God, he's not much of a God. And I'm okay with that. You know, if you're ever in a church where the pastor stands up and starts acting like, you know, he has it all figured out, you might want to run. Because what he is telling you is his God is only as big as he is. It's okay to have tension and realize there is a mystery that is part of the Christian faith. But the last thing I want you to understand is Christianity, the faith of God, that God has revealed to us, is a victorious faith. I want you to understand that the morning that this book rolled off the presses, God didn't grab it, open it up, and go, oh my gosh, I had no idea somebody was going to write this about me. You know, he didn't stop in, you know, at the Galaxy Theater down in Chesterfield and go, man, I've heard all about this movie. Let me go see what it's all about. And sit down and go, oh my, what am I going to do? I mean, that's not the God that has revealed himself to us. The God who has revealed himself to us was not caught off guard, okay? He knows what's going on. He is a God who is victorious. And by the way, there's nothing new in this book. The things that Dan Brown raises in the book, The Da Vinci Code, have been questions that have been asked about the church for the last 2,000 years. And for 2,000 years, the church has been giving the answers that God has passed on to them. That's what I want us to wrestle with today. It's going to be an interesting talk. If you're not a history person, you're going to have to hang with me, because I'm going to tell you some history that he challenges, that if you don't understand the history of the way God worked through the church, you may go, well, you know, even this Bible that I picked up is a scam because, you know, a bunch of guys sat down and voted on it. And that's not really what happened. You need to understand a little bit of the history to wrestle with the issues of the book and the movie. And so that's kind of what I want to do this morning, is I want you to see that this is all about God. It's his idea. It's his plan. That when people question it, that's not something we should run from and hide from. It's something we should embrace, because it gives us an opportunity to say, listen, the faith that I hold, if you're a Christ follower in here, the faith that you hold is not something you came up with. It's something that God has passed on to us. He revealed it. He is big enough to handle it, and I can just trust him, be okay with tensions and some mystery in it, but then I can turn around and engage people in conversations because I can trust that God is big enough to defend himself. That's my problem. My problem, you may not be like this at all, my problem is that when stuff like this happens, my first reaction is to get mad and want to take him on head on and fight for God. God doesn't need my help fighting for himself. But I can engage people in loving conversations to point them to the fact that there is a God who's crazy about them, that loves them deeply, and that even though this book has questions, God will give us the answers. He reveals himself, and we can see that, okay? And so we're kind of wrestling with these five questions. There's different questions. Was Jesus married, and who was Mary Magdalene last week? Was he just a good man? Today, I want to wrestle with the questions. First of all, did the early church lie to us? That's one of the big assumptions that is thrown out in the book, that the early church was, you know, they didn't believe anything we believe now, and that around 325, they just made a bunch of things up, and they did that for power. Is that a true statement? I mean, if we look at the evidence, is that the way it really happened? And then the second question I want us to wrestle with this morning is this. Are there more gospels? We have four gospels in the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But Dan Brown makes a statement that there were actually about 80 biographies and stories of the life of Jesus that were circulated, and that a bunch of people got in a room one day and threw out all the ones they didn't like, and they decided just to keep four that supported their viewpoint. Is that a real approach? The reason I want to do this is to help you, first of all, if you're kind of a seeker, you're kind of checking Christianity out, and you've heard these things, and you're just kind of working through it, I want to show you that there is another side of this, you know? He's kind of got this magic loogie that's suspended in midair, and if we'll stop for a minute and just take a good hard look at it, maybe it doesn't come out the way he says it does. If you're somebody who's a follower of Jesus, I hope that this will challenge you to engage people in conversations, ultimately pointing them to the God who's revealed himself. And so let's look at the first question. That is this. Did the early church really lie to us? Did the early church really just make up a bunch of stuff so that they could support their beliefs? On page 253 in the Da Vinci Code, the characters, main characters, Teabing and Sophie, are having a conversation. And they're talking about the Council of Nicaea, which took place in 325. A.D., about 300 years after the life of Jesus, was a council where the church came together, and some things happened in that council that are huge in the Christian faith. But they're talking about that, and this is what they say. Sophie says this, "Hold on, you're saying that Jesus' divinity was a result of a vote? A relatively close vote at that," Teabing added. "Nonetheless, establishing Christ's divinity was crucial to the further unification of the Roman Empire and to the new Vatican power base. By officially endorsing Jesus as the Son of God, Constantine turned Jesus into a deity who existed beyond the scope of the human world, an entity whose power was unchallengeable." Goes on a little bit later, Teabing's talking. "It's all about power," Teabing continued. "Christ as Messiah was critical to the functioning of the church and the state. Many scholars claim that the church literally stole Jesus from his original followers, hijacking his human message, shrouding it in an impenetrable cloak of divinity, and using it to expand their own power. I've written several books on the topic." Now, here's what he claims. He claims that in 325 AD, that Constantine, the emperor, called a council, and at the council, he basically forced them to have a vote. And in that vote, they decided that Jesus was God, that nobody before that really believed that Jesus was God, but they had a vote, and they voted to make Jesus God. But the reason they wanted that vote was because Constantine could use that information in a pagan culture to gain political power for himself. So the question is that what happened? Well, to understand if that's possibly a true statement, we need to understand a little bit about the Council of Nicaea. Now, you got to realize this is, you know, short synopsis stuff and brief information that you can go find and just look up any, you know, web dictionary will give you this information. But before 312 AD, the church from the time of Jesus until 312 AD, about 280 years after Jesus lived and died on the cross, for that whole period of time, it was illegal in the Roman Empire to be a Christian. It was illegal. If you claimed to be a follower of Jesus, it was something that could be punishable by death. During those 280 or so years, there were some emperors who took that and took it very seriously and would break out major persecutions where they would do hideous things to Christians. You may have heard of some of the stories about Christians being fed to the lions. There's a story of one emperor whose name was Nero, who rounded up all the Christians who lived that he could find in the city of Rome, and he put them on posts, poured tar over them, and lit them on fire, and used people who were followers of Jesus as the light street lights for the city of Rome. This is the kind of stuff that went on. There would be other emperors who would be more tolerant, but they never changed the law. But even when the emperors that were more tolerant towards Christianity, they wouldn't kill Christians as emperors, it was always illegal, which meant that during that time, if a local government decided they didn't like the Christians, they could do what the Roman government wasn't, which means anywhere you lived, it was possible that if you claimed the name of Jesus, tried to share your faith with somebody else, anything like that, that what could happen to you would be death. You could lose your life, be tortured, all kinds of hideous things for the name of Jesus. And this went on for 280 years. And so the church had to be very careful about how it passed on information. And the way it did it most of the time was copying things, was writing letters and copying them through secret avenues. And this is the way the Bible was passed on to the early church. One church would have a copy of a letter that was written by Paul. Another might have a copy of the gospel that was written by the Apostle John. And they would make copies and secretly trade them so that they could build this library that they had of writings that were given by the apostles and those around them. And these were passed on, but they were done pretty secretly and without, you know, too much bringing attention, even though as people, the church would go out and they would share their faith. And sometimes there's unbelievable stories of people who were just awesome in their faith for Jesus because they believed that Jesus had died and risen again for them. But in 312, something very curious happened. In the context of a battle, the emperor at that time, whose name was Constantine, had a vision, and in that vision, he was convicted and basically turned from pagan religions and trusted Christ and became a Christian. Now, he was kind of one of these guys who he embraced Christianity, but he kind of had a hard time letting go of some of the old ways of life. But for the most part, he really became a Christian. And what he did is he issued an edict called the Edict of Milan that made Christianity where it was no longer illegal to be a Christian. You may have heard, and the book says that with that edict, he made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. That's not true. The Edict of Milan just made it where it wasn't illegal to be a Christian anymore. And so now the Christians who feared for their lives now realized a little bit different situation, which was in this situation, we now could gather and come together and talk about issues without fear of the empire catching us and putting us down. And as a result, there was a controversy going on called the Arian controversy. The Arian controversy is very interesting. I won't go into a lot of detail, but here's the deal. Basically, this guy named Arius stood up and started preaching this, that Jesus was the first thing created by God. He wasn't just a normal, ordinary man, but he was a being that was created by God, but he was created before anything else, and then God used Jesus to create everything else, and Jesus was kind of like second in command. He was almost God, but not quite like the Father, but he wasn't just a good man. He was kind of somewhere in between, half man, half God, you know, something like that. The book says that the church believed that Jesus was just an ordinary good man, just kind of a good guy, and that at 325 at the Council of Nicaea, they voted to make Jesus God. And that wasn't even addressed at Nicaea. It was the Arian controversy where this guy started preaching that Jesus was, before anything existed, Jesus was. But God created him first and made him kind of a sub-god. And then he became a man lived on this earth, died on the cross, all that kind of stuff. And they debated, and at the Council of Nicaea, one of these guys who followed Arius stood up and tried to present their doctrine, and the whole church, the whole this council of bishops responded by going, we don't believe this. And they basically wrote a creed, and when they wrote this creed, it affirmed that Jesus was God of God, light of light, and of the same substance as the Father. Now, the reason I'm telling you all this is because in the book, it claims that they just voted that Jesus, who was a good man, they voted him to be God, and it says, quote, it was a relatively close vote. You want to know what that relatively close vote was? 318-2. Two people voted with Arius, and they were the two guys who were sent by Arius to present his position at this council. The rest of this whole council affirmed that what God had given in the Bible was what they believed, and they trusted it. And so Jesus, in this passage, he says a very interesting thing to Pilate. He says, anyone who listens to the truth, if you are really listening for the truth, and you are of the truth, you're going to hear my voice. And see, this is what I believe. I believe that, like I said, the faith that we hold is a revealed faith. It is something that God gave us, and that if we'll just listen, if we'll say, listen, I don't want to just believe whatever I want to believe. I want to figure out what God is about and know this mystery, that God will speak to the hearts of people. He will speak to your heart in a very clear way so that you can know the truth. And see, there's two possibilities when we deal with the early church, the early Christians, the earlier follower of Jesus. Either the early church created truth, which means they had this guy named Jesus who was kind of a good guy. They followed him around for a couple years, and you know, some of them believed that Jesus may have been the Messiah, but he died on the cross, and then he never really rose again, but they really liked him as a teacher, and so they decided to create this religion that followed Jesus. And as they, you know, created this religion, they created all these myths that said, well, he rose from the dead and all this kind of stuff, and created something that was bigger in life out of this ordinary man. And the early church created truth. Or the other possibility is that Jesus is exactly who he claims to be. Jesus is the God who created everything, who became a man, lived on this earth, died on the cross, did everything for us. And after he did everything for us, after he died on the cross and paid for your sin and for mine, he rose again 3 days later, blew the door off of death, hell, and the grave. And now he's alive at the right hand of the Father. And what the early church passed on is not the truth that they created. The early truth just affirmed the truth that Jesus passed on to them. And that's what we have to wrestle with. Did the early church just create truth? Well, if they did, we pick and choose what we want. Or if they affirm truth, then it is truth revealed by God, and we better buy into it wholeheartedly because it starts with him. That's what we've got to wrestle with. As you read this book or any challenge, did the early church just create truth? Did they come up with a whole bunch of ideas on their own? Or did they affirm truth? But here's the thing. I wish I had a long time to wrestle with this with you. I believe that if you'll wrestle with it, the evidence will show you that the early church affirm the truth that was passed on to them by Jesus and by God himself. And if that's true, if that's factual, then I better buy into it, understand it. The second question I want to wrestle with this morning, not only did the early church lie, but second question is, are there more gospels? In the book, he claims that there's like 80, and that's not even factual. There's more like about 20 books that are out there that came from various sources, but most of them were written about 200 years after Jesus lived on the earth. And on page 254, he talks about this in the book. It says, the twist is this. Because Constantine upgraded Jesus' status almost 4 centuries after Jesus' death, thousands of documents already existed chronicling his life as a mortal man. To rewrite the history books, Constantine knew that he would need a bold stroke. From this sprang the most profound moment in Christian history. Teabing paused, eyeing Sophie. Constantine commissioned and financed a new Bible, which omitted those gospels that spoke of Christ's human traits and embellished those gospels that made him godlike. The earlier gospels were outlawed, gathered up, and burned. So what he says here is that at the Council of Nicaea, they decided to come up with a new Bible and throw out all the other stuff that didn't agree with their viewpoint. Now here's the interesting thing. At the Council of Nicaea, what was in the Bible was never even discussed. Not at all. Wasn't brought up, wasn't discussed. Constantine never mentioned it. It's not in any of the notes. There's a great history written by a guy named Eusebius who was there. He was the first great church historian. And he wrote, he wrote a history about what happened there. They never even talked about what was in the Bible and what wasn't. But here's what is true. The four Gospels were affirmed by the early church in the early second century. So around 110 to 125, they already had decided that the four Gospels were the real revelation that God had given us about Jesus. So what about all these others? Well, I don't know if you've heard, but there's been a lot of talk about the Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip was mentioned last week. What about all these other books? Pardon me. Did Philip and Thomas and these guys who walked with Jesus really write them? And the easy answer is no, because they're all 200 years after Jesus. But they were part of a movement called the Gnostics. Now, that's another interesting. If you want to engage a culture right now, you need to have a little knowledge of what Gnosticism was, because Gnosticism is this weird religion that kind of piggybacked on Christianity. They didn't want to be Christians. They just like to use the Christian ideas to promote their own views, which was that there's two gods. There's a good God and a bad God. They got in an argument one day and got in a fist fight, basically. And as they got in a fist fight, the two of them created. The good God created spirit. The bad God created material or matter. And so their basic viewpoint is that the things that are spirit are good, but if you can touch it, see it, taste it, smell it, all that kind of stuff, it's bad. And so we as humans, some of you have a spirit on the inside of you, some of you don't, and we're not sure which ones do, which ones don't, but some of you have this spirit on the inside that is this divine spark that needs to be let out. And it needs to be let out of your body. It needs to be pulled away from the trap that is the physical world around you. And the way that you get that is through this special knowledge. You're not saved from sin, you're saved from your ignorance. You get this special knowledge, and if you get this special knowledge, somehow it'll release your spirit to freedom. And the reason Jesus is so important for this is what all these other books that you are hearing about right now, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Judas, they're all Gnostic writings. What they believed about Jesus was that there were two beings that kind of took up one residence. There is Christ and Jesus. Christ is the divine spark. Jesus is this fleshly thing. And the Christ kind of hovered over and almost had a mystical deal with this person, Jesus. But at the cross, before Jesus was on the cross, Christ freed himself and is an example to us of what we all need to do, which is free ourselves from the physical world. These are the Gospels that are being told. Well, these are all the other things that all the early church really believed and now they've rejected. But the crazy thing is, all the way back to the book of 1 John in the Bible, Christians have been writing against Gnosticism. They never embraced it as something they believed. They always rejected the writings all the way through. And so as I wrestle with this, are there more Gospels? I really believe that God gives us a miracle. Jesus in verse 37 says, I've come into the world to bear witness of the truth. John 17:7, he says this, dedicate them to yourself by means of the truth. Your word is truth. I believe that God gave us this book, and it was a supernatural miracle, and that in giving us the book, that we believe, first of all, in the miracle of inspiration of the scriptures, which means that we believe that God inspired, that this book is really from him, that he gave us the scriptures, that they're not something that a bunch of people made up, but that God spoke to the hearts of men, and they wrote, and God revealed himself, that this book is literally inspired by God. 2 Timothy 3:16 says, all scripture is given by inspiration of God. We believe here that the Bible is God's idea, it's from him, and it contains what he wants us to know about himself. Not only that, we believe in the miracle of preservation of the scriptures, which means God was involved in giving us this book through church history the way he wanted it. He kept it perfect for us. And we also believe in the illumination of the scriptures, which means that when you and I now sit down and we take this book, I believe that the God who spoke to the people who wrote it also can come alongside of us and open our hearts to understand it. The Bible says, your word's a lamp unto my feet, a light unto my path. That we can understand that this book is what God gave us. Not a bunch of men writing about God. It's God giving us truth about himself, and I can know it. Now, the reason this is important, and I just want to challenge you this morning with these thoughts, is the fact that we have to wrestle with the evidence. And some people may say, well, yeah, but that's your version. You made this up. And that's a valid response. So wrestle with it for yourself. I think of Lee Strobel and Josh McDowell. These are two guys who, both of them have a similar story. Lee Strobel was an atheist who was a writer for the Chicago Tribune, and he and his wife had been married for a little while, and they'd kind of been just living the life the way they wanted to. They'd rejected God, didn't believe in God, but one day his wife became a follower of Jesus, and it really ticked him off. It really made him angry. He wasn't real happy about the fact that his wife now was a Christ follower, and so as he began to wrestle with this, she began to go to church, and he just rejected that. He was afraid she would turn into this, you know, this woman who, like, didn't know how to have fun, wouldn't go out with them anymore, and all she would do is sit in her room and, you know, hum some weird chants and go to prayer meetings all the time, and that's it. And it scared him. And so he decided, I'm going to disprove Christianity. I'm going to prove to my wife and everybody else that it's wrong. And he went on a 2-year quest to disprove Christianity. He began to examine all the evidence to prove that what his wife believed couldn't be true. And the end result is a book called The Case for Christ, where we came to realize that Jesus was exactly who he claimed to be and that Christianity is a revealed faith. Josh McDowell was going to University of California, Berkeley. He was a very intelligent person studying philosophy, and he had some friends who challenged him with the same thing. They'd become Christians, and they said, listen, just look at Jesus. Check him out. If you can disprove him, we'll believe you. But if you look at him. And so he got angry at him and said, I'm going to prove that they're nuts, they're psycho, they don't know what they're talking about. And he set out on a quest to disprove Christianity. And after a year and a half of studying, he came to the point where he realized, listen, this Jesus is exactly who he claims to be. And he gave his life to Christ. Examine the evidence. See, Kramer and Newman had to wrestle with whether or not their belief system was true, or whether, you know, and that the magic loogie just hung in midair, or whether the facts bore out something different. Eventually, they actually had another encounter that eventually changed them in a, I think it's a deep and profound way. So, check it out. Hey, I want to encourage you, don't be afraid of the book. Don't be afraid of the movie. If you haven't seen it, you don't want to, that's fine. You don't want to read it. But don't be afraid. God is still God. He's revealed himself. And if you'll just take some time to examine the truth, wrestle with it, I think eventually you will come to a point where you go, you know what? Yeah, I get this. Jesus is who he said he was. For those of you who are part of our church, this is kind of what I want to close with. So what do you do with that? Well, listen, we don't want to be a church where a bunch of people come and just absorb things on Sunday morning. We believe that we have great news that the world ought to know. And we want to be part of sharing that to Eureka and beyond. But, you know, that's not just me who's doing that. I really want to challenge you that if you're part of us, what we want to do is we want to be part of helping you reach out. We have a very simple strategy for reaching our community. It's this, 2 words, invest and invite. If you can remember those 2 words, that's our evangelism strategy. We're not going to go knocking on doors a lot, trying to get people to come to their doors. We believe that the best way to reach out to people is through relationships. And we want to encourage you to develop relationships with people, engage them in conversations, and then invite them to come hang out with Genesis. We're going to provide opportunities like that, but hopefully worship on Sunday morning is a place where you feel like, you know what, I have a friend who's kind of checking Christianity out, looking on the outside, you know, kind of peering from the outside of the fence, looking in, and I think I could bring them here. That's the type of place we want to be. And if we're not, help us wrestle with that. But we want to encourage you to start investing in relationships and then just inviting them to come hang out at Genesis with us. That's kind of how I want to close. So we think about the Da Vinci Code. The thing that it does for us, it gives us a great chance to talk to people about the truth. Pilate said, what is truth? The answer is that Jesus is. God, we love you. We praise you. Thank you for a chance to hang out with you this morning. Speak to our hearts. Remind us of the truth. And Lord, I just pray you will teach us to wrestle with that. Be okay with the mystery when we don't understand it. But realize that this is a revealed faith, not just something a bunch of people made up. You gave it to us. Help us to stand strong in that today. In your name I pray. Amen.